Ellen Bryant Voigt likes to challenge herself as a poet, experimenting with form, language, syntax, and even punctuation to take her to unexpected places.
I write poems to try to understand the world, to discover something that you would not have known, because poems are smarter than we are.
Find out how Ellen Bryant Voigt, now a MacArthur Genius Fellow, learns from technical challenges in her own poetry. Today on New Letters on the Air, a production of New Letters Magazine at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, where Voigt was the Fall 2014 Cockafair Chair Poet in Residence. This Virginia native, schooled in piano and poetry at the University of Iowa, is now a longtime resident of Vermont, where she served as the state poet from 1999 to 2003. She talks about her eighth book, the prize-winning Headwaters, with fellow poet Michelle Boisseau.
It struck me as a kind of autobiography in imagery, and it also is a poem, of course, about sources. Can you talk about how Headwaters became the title poem?
I have been working on fairly long poems that took as their stimulus particular animals. And it seemed to me that I needed to vary that formal protocol just a little bit so that I would stay alert to possibilities and not fall into mannerism, not do all the poems alike. I wrote a number of quite short ones then, about a dozen. But this one was quite a bit different. You see that it has no animal in it. And, you know, once I started thinking about the order of them and putting it together as a book, it actually was a way to solve a problem. What do you do with these anomalous poems? So do I cluster them all together, put them in the middle? Do I make another section? You know, those usual kind of formal questions about making the shape. So putting it first was a way of solving that. And then once I tried that, then I thought it has some function by doing this. It makes it a kind of enunciatory poem. Titles are usually slow for me and very often come after the poem is finished. But this one, the sense of the headwaters, that was the title, came very early. And I thought at the time that that was interesting to think about as a title for the whole collection, for all of them.
And it propels us, Headwaters, right into the book. And I'm wondering if you would read it and then maybe talk about some of the things that you were trying to engage with it.
Okay. Headwaters. I made a large mistake. I left my house. I went into the world. It was not the most perilous, hostile part, but I couldn't tell among the people there who needed what. No tracks in the snow, no boot pointed toward me or away. No snow, as in my dooryard, only the many currents of self-doubt. I clung to my own life raft. I had room on it for only me. You're not surprised. It grew smaller and smaller, or maybe I grew larger and heavier. But don't you think I'm doing better in this regard? I tried to do better.
That's the title poem from Ellen Bryant Voigt's book, Headwaters, read for New Letters on the Air. Listeners, of course, can't see this on the page, but this is a poem without any punctuation. And that is true for all the poems in this book. And so there's other kinds of negotiations that go on.
Punctuation is just a marker. We learned that in, you know, fourth grade.
Mm-hmm.
Sentence is a complete thought. And so you put the period there, and if it has a subject, if it has a predicate, then it's a complete thought. What is a complete thought? I mean, we don't really think that way. And I was hoping to sort of tutor the reader about that. It's in that last line. But don't you think I'm doing better in this regard? I tried to do better.
I was so waiting to see how that was going to trail. Of course, it's the first time I've been able to hear you read that. And it's like what I heard in my head very much.
Good.
But at the same time, I wanted to hear where it went at the end.
If I were using punctuation, where would I put the pause? There's a huge tonal difference between, but don't you think I'm doing better in this regard? I try to do better. That's one tone. Or let's say I put that question mark somewhere else. But don't you think I'm doing better in this regard? I try to do better. Oh, that's much more arch, right?
Mm-hmm.
Different tones. If one feeds into the other, which it can in this case, I believe, without confusion,
oh, yeah.
In this regard is like an adverb.
Mm-hmm.
It's a lesser part of speech. And if that can belong to both places, then what you get is a different combination of tones, which to my ear is more complex and more interesting. I think that it has in it some combinations of things, some certain amount of regret or sadness, some certain amount of earnest trying, some certain amount of leave me alone. But it's not forcing a choice of one or the other, whereas the use of punctuation certainly would. You would have to decide. I'm not interested in a reader being confused, but the way those things can be interpenetrable is very, very useful. And it also allows a kind of rapid change of tone that can happen within the line itself, and then you can bring it back. I tell you, you put the period there and stop, you're there. And so then you have to come up with a way to move from that tonal position into another one. Whereas if it's passing through there, then you can do it really rapidly so that the tonal levels just increase exponentially of what you're able to do. I have no interest whatsoever in disguising the syntax. I simply wanted to eliminate the pauses, the rests that are created by punctuation to say to a reader, no, you can't stop there. You have to keep going and get a bigger chunk. But I worked very hard to make the sentence retrievable under all of that.
You know, as the last line in the first poem, it also sets up the ethical dimension. The book goes from Headwaters to Storm, which is the closing poem. And in that scope, we wander through, as my count, 13 animals and 4 plants, trees, a birch, a larch, a privet hedge, an oak. And the birch is actually about a bride. Mm-hmm. The oak is about you as a child. What was the first poem you wrote in this book?
Groundhog.
Groundhog?
Mm-hmm.
He comes up quite a few times.
Yes, he does.
He's a fellow messenger, to use an image from your new and selected poems, messenger.
And it was the groundhog, really, that required eliminating the punctuation. There was so much in the early drafts of that poem, a huge amount of just paratactic syntax, all of which seemed to me a major problem. And yet, the more I tried to prune it back and take those things out, the more I seemed to be poking at the heart of it. It was because of the groundhog that then I thought I would try adding back in the commas and the semicolons and the colons and the dashes. I love punctuation.
Mm-hmm.
I love what it can do and the sort of denotative meaning even that it can convey and its impact on tone, all those things about it. But then got fairly excited about having to find other ways to do the same kinds of things. And any time that then you're forced out of your usual fallback positions keeps you alert. You learn new things. It makes it new to you yet again. And so I found that very exhilarating. So after Mr. Groundhog, I wrote about 4 of these within, I don't know, 10 days or a week, all without the punctuation.
Will you read Groundhog?
Yeah, or you it's one of the longer ones.
Yeah.
Okay. Groundhog. Not unlike otters, which we love frolicking, floating on their backs like truant boys unwrapping lunch. Same sleek brown pelt, some overtones of gray and rust. Though groundhogs have no swimming hole and lunch is rooted in the ground beneath short legs, small feet, like a fat man's odd diminutive loafers, not frolicking, but scurrying layers of fat. His coat gleams as though wet, shines chestnut sable, darker head and muzzle lower into the grass, a dark triangular face like the hog-nosed skunk, another delicate nose and not a snout. Doesn't it matter what they're called? I like swine, which are smart and prefer to be clean, using their snouts to push their excrement to the side of the pen. But they have hairy skin, not fur. His fur shimmers and ripples. He never uproots the mother plant. His teeth, I think, are blunt, squared off like a sheep's. If cornered, does he cower like sheep or bite like a sow with a litter? Is he ever attacked? He looks to me inedible. He shares his acreage with moles, voles, ravenous crows. Someone thought up the names. His other name is Botched Algonquin, but yes, he burrows beneath the barn where farmer once dried cordwood. He scuttles there at speech, cough, laugh. At lawnmower, swollen brook, high wind, he lifts his head as Gandhi did, small tilt to the side, or stands erect like a prairie dog or a circus dog. But dogs don't waddle like Mao with a tiny tail. He seems asexual like Gandhi, like Jesus. If Jesus came back, would he be vegetarian also? Pinko, freako, homo? In Vermont, natives scornful of greyhounds from the city self-appoint themselves woodchucks, unkempt hairy macho, who would shoot on sight an actual fatso, shy, mild marmot, radiant as the hog-nosed skunk in the squirrel trap, both cleaner than sheep, fur fluffy like a girl's. Maybe he is a she. It matters what we're called. Words shape the thought. Don't say rodent and ruin everything.
Groundhog by Ellen Bryant Voigt from her collection Headwaters. You're listening to New Letters on the Air. I'm Michelle Boisseau. Groundhog is something like our patron saint of February. He's the marker of time in America, which to me is always a crucial point, is that it's getting lighter. There's this other element that's going on in this poem and in this book. It's about time. Mm-hmm. Experience of time as we break it into days and into times. And there's also the blurring of it, which we have when we are enthralled or in pain. And so as we're looking at the book, how these animals come to be means of understanding how the mind works. You have a bunch of them who appear later in the book. The skunk who just sort of passes out when at one point we have references to the other creatures. Can you talk about how they organize themselves?
The shape of the structure of the whole book has as its primary concern the individual soul. So that the notion of the isolated individual and then whatever connections to the world that is around and how that might that be defined. So there are a number of the poems that I think try to take a look at that, and just a large extent, the soul selects its own society. And so this particular soul seems to select creatures out of the natural world more easily than creatures out of the human world. So there are people out there. Were they hostile? No. Were they dangerous? No. But what is it that they want? And how does the individual figure that out about what the obligation is or what they might want? The animal out of the natural world doesn't want anything. The animal does not want anything from you, period.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And we intrude in the animal world very often, and we can do damage. And I think that the groundhog being hunted by the local Vermonters is not an extreme example of that. So that's a place where that interaction, then humans have the power. So it becomes who is hunted and who is the hunter. But in terms of the individual soul trying to figure that out, how do you maintain integrity as the individual and yet have some connection to the outer world? Then the animals are an entree into that because they do not ask anything. So it seems to me that that's how they function in the book to a large extent. And as you've already noticed, the relationship then of that recurring I is not in all the poems, but as the central figure, then that shifts over time. And the openness of the animals to being observed, that shifts too. And so some of those little relationships change. But sometimes those creatures seem to provide a helpful lesson, but it's not really because they are in the natural world and we are not, even though we like to pretend, as one of the poems says, as Noble Dog opens, we like to pretend that we were still in the natural world, but we are not. So that negotiation of the individual with whatever the surround is, it seems to me that that's the preoccupation of the book.
One of the new poems in Messenger, new and selected poems, The Hive. When I was going back and looking at that, I thought, you know, that seems to be like a beginning of some of these poems.
Yeah, I think it probably was. I didn't write for a long time after I put together Messenger. I found that sort of excruciating. I had been concerned about what my editor felt was sufficient number of new poems, and I really thought that doing the selected would be just a delight.
Mm.
You go back through, and then other poems that you're not sure about and are weaker, and you just get rid of those, and you just pick a couple from each book, and how hard could that be? Well, it was very hard, because those poems, you had to dismantle the context in which they existed, and I've always spent a lot of time thinking about the structure of any particular book. So this, too, I wanted to have some kind of arc, some kind of shape, and not just represent the previous volumes.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, when that was finished, then it was a long time before I really had some notion of a new project or new poems. It was a very long silence. And then it did occur to me that the previous book, The Shadow of Heaven,
mm-hmm.
that probably had some poems in it that did not become part of Messenger and were kind of unfinished work. So I went back to a couple of those also, and that was very useful.
The poem, The High Winds Flare Up in the Old
House.
That's
one of them.
Yeah, yeah.
Smart cookie. That is definitely one of them.
Yeah.
Right. Where there is
it
a kind.
It even comes up here. That even comes up under roof, and it's like here.
Yes,
here.
The High Winds.
And there's a lot of winks all the way back through all your books,
yes.
You know, of course.
Oh.
And there's threads that are picked up.
Double stitching. I think of it. Yeah. Double stitching. No, that's exactly one of them, where you have this long unfolding extended sentence. And again, a good deal of what, for some other poem, I might think of as excess. Either direct repetition or syntactical repetition. This other kind of possibility that happens when you have that kind of energy source, that mm-hmm. search for additional nuance around the thing. Yeah, exactly.
That poem, High Winds Flare Up in the Old House Shutters,
mm-hmm.
there is a kind of anger with death and anger of seeing your friends taken and a desire to fight back
yes.
with the poem.
Yes, I think that's true.
Should we read that poem?
High winds flare up and the old house shudders. The dead should just shut up. Already they've ruined the new plowed field. It looks like a grave. Adjacent pine woods, another set of walls. In that dark room, a birch, too young to have a waist, practices sway and bend, slope and give. And the bee at vertical rest on the outside pane, belly facing in, one jointed limb crooked to its mouth, the mouth at work. My lost friend, of course, who lifelong chewed his cuticles to the quick. Likewise, Jane, who calls from her closet of walnut and silk for her widower to stroke her breasts, her feet. Although she has no breasts, she has no feet, exacting pity in their big white bed. The dead themselves are pitiless. They keen and thrash, or they lodge in your throat like a stone, or they descend as spring snow, as late light, as light-struck dust rises and descends, frantic for more, more of this earth, more of its flesh, more death. Oh, yes, and a few more thousand last vast blue cloud-blemished skies.
High Winds Flare Up and the Old House Shutters from Ellen Bryan Voigt, reading from her new and selected poems, Messenger, from 2007. And I'm Michelle Boisseau, and this is New Letters on the Air, and we have been talking about her newest collection, Headwaters.
I think that there is a kind of fierceness in Headwaters and in a number of the poems. The lesson is to find something else, to find some sort of accommodation or acceptance. I don't know that I have, but that's why I needed some other tonal possibilities in the poem to let that happen if it could happen.
You said it came after some time of silence and some regrouping, and it had to find a way of writing the poem so that you could have an intellectual problem to solve, to corral some of the things.
I'd say a formal problem. That's been true of every one of my books. I mean, I've always had a silence after a book until whatever new thing came along. It's always been a formal issue. And very often, sometimes at a little assignment I would give myself mm-hmm. because I would discover something putting together the previous book. I would discover, now here you have these sort of exercises in tone. in two trees with all those short little poems in there. And there's no irony. That's what you should focus on. I mean, you're in your 40s and have no irony in your makeup. And that's what then led me to Kyrie. Or even previous to that, to say, the narrative circumstances are all terribly elided. And almost all of these poems in the first two books, you should really figure out how to tell a story. And so then that became an assignment.
Mm-hmm.
So I ended up with narrative poems then that worked well enough that that became The Lotus Flowers.
Mm-hmm.
So that business that you take on some sort of project to try to expand not just your capacity, but through that to expand your understanding of the world, to discover something that you would not have known, because poems are smarter than we are.
Mm-hmm.
So to be involved in something that's smarter than you are normally will take you someplace that you couldn't have anticipated. Sometimes you have to insert a little discipline there, either by giving yourself an assignment or you can give yourself a negative assignment. Do not write any more poems with animals in them, Ellen. Do not write any more poems with trees in them. I may not write any more poems because I've now forbidden myself a whole bunch of subject matter.
On one of the poems, I really want to make sure that I get you to talk about my mother, because the beginning of it sounds to me like someone on the edge of a high dive, bouncing a few times to get the courage to dive. And that sort of sounds like the rhythm. I think that poem includes a lot of tonal shift.
That poem also, I mean, you know, fiction writers do this all the time. I mean, because that poem goes in and out of her voice, not through dialogue or anything. But this is also one that's in, you know, fixed stanza. My mother, she could do anything, so she did everything. The world was an unplowed field, a dress to be hemmed, a scraped knee. It needed a casserole. It needed another alto in the choir. Her motto was apply yourself. The secret of life was spreading your gifts. Why hide your light under a bushel? You might forget it there in the dark times, the lonely times. The sun gone down on her resolve. She slept a little first, so she'd be fresh. She put on a little lipstick, drawing on her smile. She pulled that hair up off her face. She pulled her stockings on. She stepped into her pumps. She took up her matching purse, already packed with everything they all would learn. They would be nice. They would apologize. They would be grateful. Whenever they had forgotten what to pack, she never did. She had a spare. She kissed your cheek. She wiped the mark away with her own spit. She marched you out again, unless you were that awful sort of stubborn, broody child who more and more I was, who once had been so sweet, so mild, staying put where she put me. What happened must have been the bushel I was hiding in. The sun gone down on her resolve. She slept a little first, so she'd be fresh. She pulled her stockings on. She'd packed the words for my every lack. She had a little lipstick on her teeth. The mark on my cheek would not rub off. She gave the fluids from her mouth to it. She gave the tissues in her ample purse to it. I never did apologize. I let my sister succor those in need and suffer the little children. My mother knew we are self-canceling. She gave herself a lifetime C, an average grade. From then on out, she kept the lights on day and night. A garden needs the light. The sun could not be counted on. She slept a little day and night. She didn't need her stockings or her purse. She watered, she weeded, she fertilized. She stood in front, the tallest stalk, keeping the deer, the birds, all the world's idle, shameless thieves away.
That's Ellen Bryant Voigt reading My Mother, her poem from her 2013 book, Headwaters. This is New Letters on the Air. It gives her biography in her mother's voice and the internal nagging that one always hears with one's mother. But at the same time, it places her within the context of how she grew up and her decline, movingly, I think, and fairly.
Oh, good. Well, that's free indirect discourse, I think is what the fiction writers say. When you can snatch some of the language anyway, then you're also snatching, I think, parts of the character. That was one of the early ones. And you can hear, as with the groundhog, there's a lot of direct repetition, same phrase over and over again.
Yeah.
And also highly paratactic syntax. So just these short sentences, especially there at the end. So that kind of repetition, which was both what made me think that I needed to remove the punctuation. I would go further. I would say it would be extremely difficult if you stopped after every one of those, if you had a pause.
Yeah.
It makes it melodramatic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Rather than one thing sort of leading to the other. Especially in this one has among the longest lines in the book. That took me a little while to figure out, to make sure the breath would last all the way through to the end of the line.
I felt that this was one of the early poems.
Yeah,
because it seemed like it has a kind of rhythm in it that sort of like propels, like, you know, once you get dive into the water, there's the waves that are sent out into the other poems.
And well, it's a patterned stanza, and I had done this before. I had done this in The Art of Distance, which is a long sequence in an earlier book with a patterned stanza so that the first line and the last lines are short, and then the longest line is in the dead middle. It picks up a kind of momentum throughout the stanza and then brings it back down again. So it makes a kind of shape. And it was useful to have had the practice with that stanza before, because then this one, it gave me a way that every single stanza does that, right? With that little blip, little something bouncing on the diamond board. That's a good way to think about it. And then the last line will be even shorter.
Which is the kind of trajectory of a life, you know?
Yes, it's true.
Shakespeare would tell us. Right?
Shakespeare would. Get shorter and shorter. Yeah. I've noticed.
Which is one of the things in the poem Storm too, is this kind of confrontation. Which is the final poem in the book? Do you want to read one more poem?
Storm. 1 minute, a slender pine, indistinguishable from the others. The next, its trunk horizontal, still green, the jagged stump, a nest for the flickers. 1 minute, high wind and rain, the skies lit up. The next, a few bright winking stars, the lashing of the brook. 1 minute, an exaltation in the apple trees, the shadblow trees. The next, white trash on the ground, new birds, or the same birds crowding the feeder. 1 minute the children were sleeping in their beds. You got sick, you got well, you got sick. The lilac bush we planted is a tree. The cat creeps past with something in her mouth. She's hurrying down to where the culvert overflowed. 1 minute bright yellow marsh marigolds springing up. The next, the farmer sweeps them into his bales of hay.
Storm, the last poem in Ellen Bryant Voigt's book, Headwaters, winner of the 2014 Arthur Rents Poetry Prize from the American Academy of Arts and Letters. She also read from Messenger, New and Selected Poems, 1976 to 2006, winner of the Poets Prize. She's now one of two creative writers awarded the 2015 MacArthur Genius Fellowship. For links to her books and an earlier 1988 interview, go to newletters.org and click on the air. You can also find links to shows featuring the poetry of Michelle Boisseau, who did today's interview for New Letters on the Air, a production of New Letters Magazine at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, where Voigt was the 2014 Cockafair Chair Poet in Residence. Thanks to Jamie Walsh, Elizabeth Albano, Ashley Wan, Brittany Green, and Coy Duggar for production help. I'm Angela Elam for New Letters on the Air.